This is episode number 541 with the number one New York Times bestselling author, Gretchen Rubin.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
Donald Miller said, when you stop expecting people to be perfect, you can like them for who they are. And welcome to this episode with the sensational Gretchen Rubin. If you don't know who she is the author of several books, including the blockbuster New York Times bestsellers, Better Than Before, The Happiness Project, and Happier at Home. She has an enormous readership, both in print and online, and her books have sold almost 3 million copies worldwide in more than 30 languages. Now, she hosts the popular weekly podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin. Fast Company named Gretchen to its list of the most creative people in business, and she's a member of Oprah's Super Soul 100. She's also a three-time number one New York Times bestselling author. And I'm so excited about our interview today. She's in the Greatness Studio. And some of the big things we talk about are the four tendencies that human beings have with their personality and how this affects you at home, at work, and in your life. We talk about what these four tendencies are, how you can understand which one you are and understand what everyone else is around you. We talk about the best way to tell someone how to work with your personality type, why people are the way they are, the four ways people respond to certain expectations. That and so much more in episode number 541. If you want to watch the full video interview, make sure to check out the full show notes at lewishowes.com/541. There are a lot of great quotes over there on the show notes. Make sure to tweet them out. Tag your friends on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and tag me as well when you're posting this so I can connect with you on social media and say thank you for listening. All right, guys, I hope you enjoy this one all about happiness and understanding human nature. Episode number 541 with the one, the only Gretchen Rubin.
Remember the Thai cave rescue? What about the mission depicted in Black Hawk Down or the epic rescue shown in Captain Phillips? You've probably heard of all of these, but did you know that the U.S. Air Force Special Warfare played a pivotal role in all of them? These airmen are the most highly trained warriors on the planet. Other forces like the SEALs and Army Rangers call on them to provide skills no one else can. Not many people make the cut. If you think you can, visit airforce.com to learn more.
I don't know about you, but when around 3 p.m. hits, I find myself craving the right refreshment to get me through that mid-afternoon slump. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea is full-flavored sweet tea, but without the sugar and the calories. It might take several bottles for you to believe that a delicious sweet tea can really have zero sugar and zero calories. But you know what they say, life is full of surprises. Or in this case, full of flavor. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea. Try it to believe it. For 20% off your next 12-pack, head to Amazon and use promo code 20PureLeaf. That's promo code 20PureLeaf for 20% off.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4x points on your top two eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome back and more to the School of Greatness podcast. We have the legendary Gretchen Rubin in the house.
I like being legendary.
Good to see you. Double high five.
I'm
excited that you're here. The last time you were on was a couple years ago. But it wasn't in person. It was over Skype, I believe.
Yeah, and now I'm hearing your fabulous setup here.
Yes.
Like in the middle of the gorgeous LA. It's like just like you read about.
Greatness headquarters.
Yes, it lives up to it. Hopefully.
We're always trying to improve.
Yeah, that's a high bar, but I think you meet it.
The word is a high standard.
It is.
Because you can't have average stuff if you're trying to be great.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have the mediocre.
You can't do it. But you've impacted so many people's lives over the last many years with all your books. What is this, your sixth book now? Seventh book?
This is actually like my eighth or ninth book because I started writing a lot before. I had a lot of books come out before anybody sort of realized
knew about it.
Yes.
But in here, I think it shows like six previous books. Is that right? These six books.
I hope they listed them all. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is my... What?
They messed up all the books that you wrote.
They missed a book. Oh,
wow.
My gosh.
No way.
This is why I don't like seeing finished books.
Oh, trust me. Listen. No.
Oh, my gosh.
Here,
I cannot
believe
it.
Let me show you something.
I am super annoyed.
Let me show you something.
Oh, my. You know what? It's one of my... Well, I love all the books that I wrote, but it's 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill, which is such a wonderful book that I wrote. Oh, my gosh.
Gretchen's making a note right now. I just made her
mad. I am. Just, yeah. Let the record reflect that I'm writing myself
an
irate note.
I'm going to show you this. So when I got my copy, and this is an advanced copy.
See, I don't even like looking at the final copy because you always see something that's wrong and it's too late to fix it.
It's the pages.
First. It's the first thing
you
see.
I'll show you this. So
okay, good.
Right when I opened, I was like, okay, this looks nice, the first page.
It looks nice.
The second page, do you notice anything here that usually wouldn't be on this page?
Your dedication.
See, she got it right away.
The dedication is on the copyright page.
I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
And I was like,
"Yeah,
how do we miss this?"
Because
you'd think it's something so simple that would have its own page, right?
But I'm going to tell you how we're going to reframe this to make ourselves happier. So there's a belief, and I don't know if it's true, but like that in certain folk cultures, like the Amish or whomever, I've heard it attributed to different cultures, that when people are making something, say they're making a quilt or they're making a piece of furniture, they deliberately introduce a mistake to show that man cannot aspire to the perfection of God. And so this is just how you show that you're acknowledging that nothing can be perfect. And so I think you have something that's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I have something that's not perfect. And we're going to embrace this. Maybe we'll make it into a little game for our readers. Like,
find the imperfections.
Find the mistake. Okay, find the mistake in the first 5 pages. Something is missing. Something is wrong.
So I brought this to your attention. You didn't know this.
Well, I mean, I give you props for being detail-oriented, man, because that's like one of my favorite books that I've ever written, and it's not listed there.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
It's
you know,
okay.
I think what it was is they didn't list profane waste, which is a very odd, it's like an art essay that I did in collaboration with an artist. And so I think that got dropped. And so I was so busy putting that in that I didn't check to see if all the books were in.
Because you were just like, oh, they forgot this one. So let's add it. Yeah.
But despite that mistake, it's an amazing book that will change everybody's lives. So that's okay.
Which one? That one and this one.
This one.
Yes.
This one. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Why will it change everyone's lives?
Self-knowledge. I mean, I really think when people know about the four tendencies, they really do, in my vanity, I have to believe that they really do see themselves differently and more clearly. And then they understand other people better too. And they can see how to set up situations in a way that just allows everybody to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Allows them to thrive, but it's also give you like peace of mind and clarity.
Yeah.
Or what is it? What's the main thing it does for you?
Well, it's peace of mind, but it's also compassion. It's like, I understand, like you're struggling with something that's easy for me. Instead of feeling disdain for you or like being puzzled or frustrated that you're not following through in a way that would make sense to me, I think, oh, well, somebody else just needs things to be set up in a different way. So let's set up set up the situation in a way that is going to allow you to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I wouldn't need this to be set up this way doesn't really matter. It's like, okay, well, you need something different from what I need. So, okay, well, let's just figure that out.
Yeah. And Christine was going over these these tendencies, and she is the, upholder?
Obliger. Okay. Well, that's the biggest tendency. That's the one that most people fit into. So it makes sense.
She said she's, when there's challenges or rules that other people give her, she lives up to it. But if she sets her own rules, she's like, I can slide on these things.
That's obliger.
Right?
Yep.
She's like, that's me.
That is the definition of obliger.
And then what am I, Christine? I'm a rebel?
If somebody asks or tells you to do something, you're very likely to resist.
Yeah, I'm likely to resist. Unless it's like my idea.
That's right. See,
it's my vision.
Rebels can do anything they want to do. So should I go
it's
through
my
the,
way.
Should I go through the
Let's
framework?
Do it. Yes.
Okay. So it has to do with how people respond to expectations, outer expectations like a work deadline or a request from a friend, or inner expectations, your own desire to keep a New Year's resolution, your own desire to start, but write a novel in your free time. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline. They keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss.
Upholders. Anything that they set for themselves or anyone else asks them to do, yes. They do.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So like,
why do they do that?
Hermione Granger is like the most, right now is probably the most famous upholder in the world. Then questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they make everything an inner expectation. If it meets their standard, they will meet it no problem. If it fails their standard, they will resist. They hate anything arbitrary, inefficient, or unjustified. Whenever anybody uses the word arbitrary, it's like a big warning sign that it's a big signal that they're a questioner. Then obligers. So this is Christine, obliger. Yes. They readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. Like I had a friend who said, oh, well, when I was on a track team, I never missed track practice. So why can't I go running now? It's like, oh, well, when you had a team and a coach waiting for you, you had no trouble showing up. But when you're just trying to go running on your own, you struggle.
Right.
And then finally, rebels. Lewis, you're a rebel. So rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. If you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. Typically, they don't even want to tell themselves what to do. Like they might not say, like, I'm not going to sign up for a 10 a.m. spin class on Saturday because I don't know what I'm going to feel like doing on Saturday.
I don't like planning anything.
Yeah, that's the thing. Spontaneity.
Wait until the last minute, I'll plan and commit.
Yeah, no, a lot of spontaneity. Again, like there's certain things that people say and you're like, that's a tip off. When anybody's trying to talk about like it's important to be spontaneous, I'm like, I bet you're a rebel.
So but someone who likes to schedule out a year in advance, who is that?
Well, that could be upholders or questioners or obligers, though It's very typical of upholders. But the thing about rebels, and I think you're a great example of this, Lewis, is they can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do. You and I are both friends with Chris Guillebeau. Great, mm-hmm. a brilliant guy. He's a rebel. Because once they make up their mind, they can do anything. But the fact that you're telling them to do something is not going to make them do it and might make them be like, you know what? You're not the boss of me. I'm not going to do that right now. Right. Or I'm not going to do it at all.
Right.
Because...
it's almost reverse psychology. You tell me I can't do something, then I'm going to rebel against you and say, you know what? I'm going to show you.
So in that, people can use that. So for instance, let's say you have a rebel in your life and you want to encourage that person to quit smoking. You wouldn't say you have to quit. You wouldn't say you should quit. You shouldn't say the doctor says you have to quit. You shouldn't say you promised me you'd quit.
I bet you can't quit though.
Yeah. A guy like you, you've been smoking 10 years. You're addicted, man.
There's no way you can quit.
There's no way you can get. Big Tobacco's got you right where they want you. You're pouring money into their pockets.
Yep.
Why even bother?
Don't even try.
You can't. You know, don't even
keep
try.
Keep smoking for the rest
of
your life.
Yeah, keep smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah, Big Tobacco. You're the guy they're depending on. Yeah. You're stuck. You can't quit. Yeah. And then often they'll do something in their own way, too. Like doing a typical cessation program, they're like, no, I'm going to just go hardcore and quit overnight, or I'll have my own system for doing it. So that's
that. Come up with a process for them that works.
They want to do it their way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's totally.
So sometimes you could say, well, sometimes this works for some people, or some people like this, and this. I've seen people have success with this, and maybe you want to think about this when you're thinking about what would work for you. But then it's just whatever you think, you know, whatever works for you. And you know, I've seen you do amazing things in your time. If you make up your mind that you want to quit, I don't know, maybe you could quit because I've seen you do some pretty powerful stuff when that's what you want. So when you make up your mind, you know, that kind of thing.
Are we born with these tendencies, or are we?
I think they're inborn. I think they're part of our personality.
Or is it triggers of things that happen in our childhood
that make us
start resisting and reacting, and then we become rebellious or whatever? No,
I really think that these are inborn. You're not one at 20 and one at 40. You're not one at work and one at home. They're really hardwired into your personality.
You never change. Can you never change from being a questioner to upholder?
Well, okay. So one big question in sort of personality studies is, do people change? And I think, in my observation, for the most part, most people do not change. Like, you recognize the person at maybe 8 years old that they would be at 58. Like, they're basically the same person.
Yeah.
And I think for those kinds of people, you stay within your tendency. With time and experience and wisdom, you might be able to use your tendency to your advantage. Or maybe if you're in a culture, like if you're in a North Korea, being a questioner, you're going to tamp that down. If you're in Silicon Valley, you might get rewarded for it. Every once in a while, there are people who go through truly personality-altering events. Maybe it's a severe trauma. It's a brush with death. It's a serious bout of addiction. You go on a medication that really fundamentally changes the way your personality comes out. Or something so extraordinary happens to you, like, oh my gosh, you were pretty much a normal person, and now you're Diana, Princess of Wales.
Right.
And that is such an extraordinarily distorting thing to happen to somebody that I think then people's tendencies can kind of slip out of place. But I think for the basic person who's more or less the same person that they were,
you're stuck.
You're not stuck. You're born with a tendency, and you can, yes.
Can people choose to change if they want to? If they say, you know what? I don't like being a rebel. I want to be an upholder.
So this gets to another big question, which is, can you really change your inborn nature? And the fact is, if you even can, which debatable if you can, it's very, very hard and takes a long time and is an enormous struggle.
Right.
But it's super easy to change your circumstances. So what I say about the four tendencies is, if there's something you don't like about your tendency, just fix it from the outside. Like figure out the hack in your circumstances to get you wherever you want to go. So if you're an obliger and obligers, if they want to meet inner expectations, if they want to meet their own expectations for themselves, what they need is outer accountability. That is the solution that will always work. So if you want to, if you want to read a book, join a book group. If you want to exercise, join an exercise class. Or, you know, there's a million ways to create outer accountability once you realize it. And sometimes obligers will say to me, well, I don't want to have to rely on outer expectations. I want to be able to just have my own inner expectations. I don't want outer accountability.
And you won't get anything done.
Yeah. I'm just like, well, there's a quick, easy way to do this and to get done what you want to get done. Or you could spend a lot of time trying to deeply change yourself, which I think seems incredibly frustrating and probably not even possible. Mm-hmm. So why not do the quick, easy thing? You know, and that's one of the things I like about the four tendencies framework is that it really does suggest fairly simple solutions to common problems. Once you realize what the issue is, it's like, oh, okay, I see how people like me solve problems like this.
Yeah.
It's not so hard.
Yeah. What advice do you give for people who don't understand the tendencies? Like, let's say I understand these, but you don't.
Right, yeah.
How am I supposed to connect with you so that you understand my tendency and what I'm going to need to be able to effectively be a better leader with me, or communicate with me, or understand who I am?
Well, see, I think the thing
is clashing.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that happens with the four tendencies is a lot of times people don't understand what actually they need. So, like, let's say you're a questioner and you're having a lot of conflict with your boss. What you might not understand is happening is, I, as a questioner, need to have robust justification for everything if I'm going to get with the program. And so I'm asking you question after question after question because I don't understand a decision that you made. Okay, and I, as your boss, am perceiving you as being obstructionist, insubordinate. Why are you questioning my judgment? I'm feeling thin-skinned and defensive because I feel like here's somebody who's really refusing to accept my authority. So we have a conflict. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm the questioner, I could be like, okay, I see that this is something that comes up sometimes with questioners. We questioners sometimes drain and overwhelm people with our questions.
Right, right.
I need to think of a way to be more constructive in the way that I'm approaching my boss because I can see that this is causing a problem. Or I, as a boss, could say, this guy's a pain in my neck, but he's probably like this all the time with everybody he ever runs into. He has all these questions. There might be other people here who have questions. So why don't I say, like, hey, team, if you feel like you understand why we picked the software program, you do not need to come to the meeting. You know, if you don't want to know more, that's fine.
Right.
But if you feel like you would really like for us to take some time, an afternoon this week, and I'm going to really sit down and take you through the logic and the reasons that corporate used in order to pick the software. If you feel like you have questions that haven't been answered, I'd be happy to take your questions. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, I don't have to take it personally. This guy isn't, you know, he's not trying to be disrespectful. He just needs answers. So it's like, once you realize that's what's going on, it's easy to see. But it's not like both of those players need to have the other person understand. They just have to be like, oh, I see how I'm reacting to this person.
Got it. How did you do the research for this to figure these out?
You know, I'm like a street scientist, so I'm always just like looking around. It's anecdata. I'm looking to try to understand what I see around me. And I had this giant lightning bolt when very normal, ordinary moment of my life where I was having lunch with a friend, and she said something that is very, it's like something that a lot of people have said, similar things. When she said, I don't understand, when I was on the high school track team, I never missed track practice, so why can't I go running now? And that was the thing that really got me noticing patterns. And then I started noticing that, like some people, if you say, well, how do you feel about New Year's resolutions? Some people would say, oh, well, I would keep a resolution whenever it made sense for me, but I wouldn't do it on January 1st because January 1st is an arbitrary date.
So would that be a rebel then? Or
that'd be A questioner.
Questioner.
Because arbitrary, is the key. Yeah, it's like, I would do it whenever it makes sense, because that's like what's more efficient, but I'm not going to wait.
I was thinking, like, I'm not going to do it when everyone else does it. I want to do it when I want to do
it. See, that's true. But also, rebels often will say things like, I don't want to bind my, I would never bind myself to a New Year's resolution. If I want to do something, I'll do it. If I don't want to do it, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to tell myself I'm going to do it.
True.
And in fact, rebels will often say that if they do try to make a resolution, then they rebel against it. So if they're like, oh, I'm giving up bread, then they run out the next day and buy a giant loaf of sourdough bread. Or it's like, oh, I'm going to make a to-do list and do everything on my to-do list. It's like, no, I'm not going to do anything on my to-do list.
Yeah.
But so I started noticing these patterns, and it took me a long time to sort of figure out how all the pieces fit together. And it was really when I understood that the core idea is this idea of expectation, which is such a boring word. I was like searching for a synonym that sounded like juicier. But it really does come down to this outer and inner expectations. And once you see that, then all these patterns that seem very disconnected all of a sudden make sense.
Expectations is just like the killer of community. It's like the killer of relationships. When people have an expectation that's not understanding the other person's expectation and it's not met, or it is met, I feel like so much conflict happens when people aren't aware of expectations or they're not clearly defined.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes.
It's challenging.
It is challenging. No, I think.
But when we can understand the tendencies, we're going to understand someone's expectations for tomorrow, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, and it's also, I think it highlights exactly your point, which is that it's very important to think about the role they're playing. Don't have them be implicit or assumed or not discussed. It's like if you have something that you want to have happen, you need to spell that out. You know, it's like, well, if I load the dishwasher, I expect you to unload it. And then we can have a conversation about it. But it's like, don't just expect that somebody's going to volunteer and understand that this is how all right-minded people behave. Mm-hmm. They might.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. When you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. Like when you're trying to buy tickets for the best seat at your favorite team's big game, or when you're hiring for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. With ZipRecruiter, you can find qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I believe finding the right team member is one of the most important steps in setting up my company for success. We like to ensure our new hires will be a good fit before they're even on the team. So I am grateful that I have ZipRecruiter's help when we want to grow the team fast. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
What makes you so curious about these things? Like about, you know, the happiness project, this, all the stuff you've been doing. Why are you so curious to know all these things?
I think this has just always been my subject. And all my books, including the one that's not listed in my book, my latest book, it's all about human nature. It's like trying to understand why are people what are we like? Why do we do what we do? How can people change? Like, Why can people change sometimes but not other times?
Why
are people
curious,
alike
though?
And different? I don't know. It's always been the thing that's most interested me. In fact, it was so interesting to me, it didn't occur to me that it was an interest. It just seemed like the thing that everybody in the world was interested in. It didn't seem like a specialty in a way. It took me a while to realize, like, oh, this is a subject.
Yeah. Were you always curious as a kid, too? Just about these things?
Yeah.
Or people and observing people?
Well, I've always been a huge reader. And so I think that's how it comes out, is just always wanting to read more and more and more. Because that's a great way to learn about human nature is through reading.
You still read a lot today?
I do. I do read a lot.
Every week, a new book, two books?
Yes. And in fact, on my Facebook page, every Sunday night, I do a thing, a hashtag Gretchen Rubin Reads, where all I do is post a picture of the books that I've read that week. And I always, this is one of the things I did for the Happiness Project, is I stop reading any book that I don't like. So if you see it in the stack, it means I liked it well enough to finish it.
Oh.
But I don't otherwise editorialize about it, because it would just be, I read a lot, so it would just take too much time to write like a little thing.
Do you speed read it all, or do you actually like read it word for word? Do you skip over stuff and kind of like first chapter, last chapter?
No, I mean, I'm certainly not trained in speed reading. I don't do anything that's officially speed reading. I must read pretty fast, because I feel like I never have time to read. It's like this huge thing that I'm constantly working on in my book, Happier at Home, and also in Better Than Before, All Bad Habits. I talked a lot about the habits of reading more, which is a habit that a lot of people want. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm never reading, and yet I do read several books a week. So I must be reading some fairly fast, but I really feel like I'm always fighting to have that. But one of the things I love about a book tour, I don't know when you go on book tour, how you use your time, but a friend of mine gave me a great piece of advice. She's like, when I travel for business, I only read for pleasure. So she never tries to work on a plane when she's traveling for work. She's like, that's my time to read for fun. It's totally transformed my travel, because instead of either working or feeling guilty about not working, I'm like, I have this huge stack of books that I'm for pleasure. Yes, that I'm slowly reading on my book
tour.
Because I love reading on airplanes. It's one of my favorite times, because you're not interrupted.
Yeah.
It's quiet. You're just like, you've got nowhere else to go. You don't have to jump up and deal with anything. You're just
in your
seat.
You're not waiting for the Wi-Fi to load while you get your emails.
No.
Sitting there for 5 minutes for one email and frustrated. Yeah.
Yeah,
like me last night.
Oh, yeah. I know that feeling. Or it's just like, loading. And
everyone else, get off Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I know. So I've been, I love getting the chance to do some hardcore reading.
What brings you the most joy in your life?
Reading. Reading and writing, probably.
The
I mean, my
joy.
Family, of course, and my friends. But I mean,
the
like
way she said that. My family.
No. I mean, like, feel like that's like understood. It's like that's sure, always sure. like. Let's can we stipulate to the fact that people are the most important. But in terms of activities,
reading and writing brings
definitely.
The most joy.
I mean, I am a person of very narrow interests. I like that's basically the only thing I like to do is read and write.
Is there anything that you're afraid to write about?
Interesting question. I wouldn't write about something that would cause extreme distress to somebody close to me.
You mean revealing something or talk about them in a way that would hurt them or?
Right. And actually, like, nothing's really happened in my life. There's nothing I would disclose. There's no secret that I would reveal. But if I was going to be like snarky, I mean, one of the things that I'm sure as a writer, you felt this too, you can get your digs in. Like, there's sometimes, you know, you're like, or even to characterize something. I mean, it's interesting to me, but like, my husband never reads anything that I write, which some people find shocking. I totally get it, because it's like going inside someone's head in a way. It feels like, in a way, you've crossed a barrier that's usually there. And I think for my husband, that just gives him the heebie-jeebies. So I wouldn't want to write something that would be really, you know, just for whatever reason, some observation or something that would just be hurtful to somebody.
Yeah.
I write about happiness. I don't want to create tremendous unhappiness to the people I love by saying something. But AJ Jacobs told me a good trick. This is good for any aspiring writers out there.
I just got a new book in the mail today, actually.
Yeah. I love AJ Jacobs. He's the funniest guy. And so he writes a lot of like not so much now, but at one point he was writing a lot of celebrity profiles. And he also writes a lot about his own family. He's written unflattering things about members of his own family. And I was like, well, how did that go over? And he said, well, I've learned this, that if whenever you write about somebody, you write about in some way that they're very attractive, they will forgive you anything. So it's like he said all these kind of mean things about one member of his family, but he was like described him as lean or something like that. And he was like, oh, all is forgiven.
All is forgiven.
Yeah. So, but I don't want to get into that kind of thing.
What about... any other fears that you have right now that you're facing? since you're so focused on happiness a lot and talking about these things, is there anything that you're afraid of tackling? Any topics you're afraid of tackling?
It's funny. I don't know. I'd have to think about that, because what I feel more is like the pull to write about so many things. And I guess my fear is like, I don't want to commit to something that's not big enough. Like lately I've been wanting to write little books. Like I wrote this little book, which I haven't dealt with, which I'm going to do once the Four Tendencies is sort of out in the world, called Outer Order, Inner Calm, which is all about just sort of like outer order, which is just a subject that I love. It's little.
So outer order.
Yeah, because one of my secrets of adulthood is that outer order contributes to inner calm more than it should for most people. Mm. Not for everyone, certainly, but for most people, they feel more energetic, they feel calmer, they feel more creative when there's orderliness in their environment.
Cleanliness, order.
Which for different people, some people want like absolutely nothing on their desk. Some people want neat piles. I mean, some people love abundance. They like profusion, but nobody likes to have a lot of junk around or a lot of trash or like a bunch of stuff they don't use anymore. They don't even like, what is this cable? I don't even know.
Yeah.
It's just sitting there because I'm scared to throw it away because maybe it's useful, but I haven't used it in 2 years. But what do? You know, it's just on the counter. Get rid of that. So I have all these like little books. And so I'm like, well, should I do a big book next? Or should I do a little book? I had this idea for this. I've been obsessed with the subject of color. I'm like, really? I want to write a little book about color, which has nothing to do with anything. And no one will read it except for me. But I just feel this compulsion to write a little book about color. So I'm sort of like trying to figure out, usually I'm hit by a lightning bolt and I know what I want to write. And I feel this compulsion to tackle a subject. And right now I'm feeling pulled in a lot of different directions. So that's what I'm trying to figure out.
So you're like, not sure.
Because they all feel interesting. And so I'm like, what do I do next? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
How many times a day do you get, what's next? When you come out with a book, you get that a lot,
two,
right?
Two or three,
What's next? This is out right now.
Yeah, I know.
But what's next?
I know.
It's like, this is what I'm focused on.
Yeah, you're like, what's next? This. Yes.
But a little book about color, I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, no, I'm obsessed with color. Well, one of the things I need to write first is a Four Tendencies quiz for children. This is something that I've been really, ever since the book has sort of been on the horizon, many, many people have asked me to write a quiz for, because I have this quiz, which is at happiercast.com/quiz. It's a short quiz for adults.
Happiercast?
Happiercast.com/quiz.
It's where you can get the one for adults.
Yes.
This quiz.
Yeah, and I'm coming up on a million people having taken it, which is amazing. I know. Huge number of people have taken it.
That's a lot of data, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had to do a representative sample because, of course, the people taking the quiz, it's a biased sample, so you couldn't use that. But I did do a representative sample to solve for that problem. But so many people have said, oh, will you create one for children? It's a challenge because, of course, an 8-year-old is different from an 18-year-old. So I need to sit. But so many people, either readers or podcast listeners of the Happier Podcast, have sent me suggestions, like teachers and parents and coaches and instructors, of scenarios that might be work for children, but I need to sit down and do that. It won't take long, but it's going to take a lot of concentration because it's tricky.
It's a lot.
Writing the quiz took a long time. It's hard to think of scenarios that are universal enough that a lot of people respond to them, but that also show you the difference between the four tendencies. Mm-hmm. It was a big intellectual challenge.
Wow. And where are most of the people take the quiz from in the adult version? Is it from the U.S. mostly, or is it from all over the world?
It's all over the world. I think it's mostly from the U.S., but no, I get people all the time from other countries. Mm. Yeah.
Do you ever feel like you're going to run out of things to write about?
No, I don't feel like that. No.
You have like a list of a million ideas
to
fall back on?
I do feel like I have a million things. And then things occur to me. Like the four tendencies. I mean, so I was writing Better Than Before, which was all about the 21 strategies we can use to make or break our habits. And it was in trying to understand how people successfully transform habits that I stumbled into the four tendencies. So I had no idea that I was even going to write about it until that book came out. And people were just deluging me with questions about the four tendencies. And finally, I was like, well, this is the book that I need to write next. So it wasn't part of sort of a long trajectory. It kind of popped into view.
Do you ever feel like your podcast has taken off in a big way? Do you ever feel like your books will become less read and your podcast will become more popular? And does that scare you that your writing is going to be less relevant or meaningful to
people? Less central.
Yeah, or just like, oh, why read when I can just listen?
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I have been very struck.
Because your podcast is blowing up.
Yeah, the Happier podcast is, yes. And a lot of people will say, like, they clearly know me first as a podcaster.
Really? They know you first as a podcaster?
Yeah, and then they're like, oh, and then I went and read your books or something like that. Whereas for me, my book identity is my central identity, and my identity as a writer, to me, is central. But what I've started to see is really... I want to reach people however they want to be reached. And some people want to read a book, and some people want to watch a live video, and some people mm-hmm. want to listen to a podcast, and some people want to read a blog post. And a lot of times, you know, at one time in your life, something makes sense. And then at another time, you realize something else mm-hmm. makes sense, or you have a certain, like, let's say you're walking your dog. Well, walking your dog is a great time to listen to a podcast. It's not a great time to read a book or watch a video.
Right.
So now, oh, you have a new puppy. Well, guess what? You've got a lot of time to listen to podcasts, or you've got a new long commute. But then let's say you don't have a commute. You're now you've moved to New York City and you're on the train. Mm. Well, this is great. You have so much more time to read. So now you're going to read. So I want to be able to reach people wherever they want to be, in whatever form they like to get ideas. For me, writing, the thing about writing is you can get it exactly right. You know, when you're speaking, unless you script it out, it's not exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you don't find the perfect verb the way if you're writing, you can be like, oh, first I had, you know, ask, then I had grill, then I had demand. Like, you can get it exactly the right word, and you can lay out a big idea. I mean, one of the things that I've heard about the four tendencies is we talk about it a lot on the podcast, on the Happier podcast. And it was a chapter in Better Than Before. And now people are saying to me, I thought I knew all about it, because I've heard you talk about it, I read Better Than Before, but now it's laid out in so much more nuance and complexity. Mm-hmm. Because a book, you can really get into those subtleties that it's very hard to do in other forms. There's all media have their strengths, and for a book, a big idea to really communicate at many levels, you need to do that through writing.
Now, The Happiness Project, was that 4 books ago? 3 books ago?
That was 4 books ago.
And that was your most popular book, your biggest selling?
That was the one that most people identify me with. Yeah.
And how do you feel when you come out with you have this mega hit? I think you got a couple million copies sold right?
Yeah.
Mega hit. And everyone identifies you as that person. How do you feel as a writer when you still have new ideas? When people still associate you with that one idea, and you feel like, well, maybe I'm not selling as well with these new books, or maybe that'll be my best book or most sold book.
Uh-huh.
Do you have those conversations with yourself? I think of Elizabeth Gilbert. She's like, my greatest book is behind me. Like, I'll never sell 10 million copies of a book again, probably. Maybe.
Right.
But most likely not.
Right. I'm going to go to the Oscars again.
Right.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because I never really thought about that. I mean, to me, I still feel very close to The Happiness Project. So it doesn't, and it feels very integrated into what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, I think sometimes if you've really moved on and you're in a totally different subject, maybe that feels like a chapter of your life or something, you know, like... It's sort of like your former self. Mm-hmm. And when you're asked to talk about it, it's like being an employee of your former self. It's not like who you are right now. Whereas for me, the things that I talked about in The Happiness Project are still things that are very much part of what I'm talking about
every
now.
Day.
And so it all feels very integrated to me. And it's exciting to me that so many people read it or recognize it, but it feels very much of a piece of what I'm still interested in. I could see how that would be difficult if you were... Because I know a lot of nonfiction writers, and for many nonfiction writers, the pleasure comes from, oh, I'm going to learn all about this, and then I'm going to learn all about that, and I'm going to go from kind of one world to another world. So that could be discouraging if you felt like everybody cared about this, but nobody cares about that. But for me, they all feel very tied together. But one of the interesting things, though, in looking at The Happiness Project in retrospect, is the thing that puzzled me when that book came out is so many people said to me, but how did you get yourself to do all those things? How did you get yourself to keep all those resolutions? And I said, well, I made resolutions that I thought would make me happier. And then if they did make me happier, I kept them. And they would just look puzzled, and they would say, right, but how did you get yourself to do them? I was like, I don't really understand what you're talking about. Now I know. I'm an upholder. Right. This is what upholders are good at, setting outer and meeting outer and inner expectations. So of course it was easy for me. So now I understand like what all those people were saying. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I should write an epilogue. Like, by the way, if you're thinking, oh my gosh, how the heck do I get myself to put down my devices? She makes it sound so easy. I'm like, okay, now I have an answer for you.
That's your next podcast.
Yeah.
There you go.
Right.
That's your podcast. Talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
What would you say has been the biggest transformation for you from your first book to this book?
Well, adding the podcast was a huge new aspect of my identity.
Because now some people are finding you just from the podcast. Yes. And they never read a book of yours,
yes,
right?
Yeah. So that's interesting. That's probably the biggest transformation. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Is this whole new... Because I was a blogger, you know, and I did the whole, you know, South by Southwest. And the world of podcasting really reminds me of the world of blogging at a certain mm-hmm. point. But blogging is much closer to writing. Whereas I feel like podcasting is a whole different, it's much more performative. So that's been a big transformation. And I do it with my sister. So this is a collaboration. Whereas as a writer, I always work by myself. So that's been really exciting to have like a partner and to do something with her, which has been tremendously gratifying. And it's also just like a different way of working. That's really nice.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned about yourself since launching the podcast?
That I say like too much. Yeah.
When you hear yourself back.
Yeah, 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 like, yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. Yes.
You say I know too much also.
I know. There you go. Yeah, yes. Everybody's got their tick. Their I know. Their,
I'm sure Christine edits out everything of all my ticks all the time, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe she doesn't. I don't listen to any of my episodes.
So that's interesting.
I can't listen to him.
I listen to him because I do the show notes.
Well, Christine does it all.
Okay,
so
she does
thankfully,
it. So, yeah. Okay, so you don't have to listen.
She edits it. She listens. I record and then I pass it to her and then I promote it.
Uh-huh.
I share it out. I think maybe I listened to like a couple of them, like with Tony Robbins or something the first time I had him on or something where I was like, ooh, I want to hear this. Like,
yeah.
See how it sounded, you know, because I was so nervous or in the moment.
Have you ever gone back to listen to like your first or your second episode just to hear?
I'm terrified. I love listening to them. I'm terrified. One of them was on my iPhone.
Yeah.
And it's just like loud noises all around. And yeah.
Keeping it real.
I don't think I have. Have I? No. She's like,
That would be good. You should do that for like a big anniversary, like for your 600th episode.
Yeah, I should.
Play the first one.
I'll probably just cringe so and I say, I can't believe I did this.
I do high-intensity weight training, and one day my trainer was like, I'm going to set you at the weights that you trained at when you first came to this gym. Mm. And I was just like, they were whipping. I mean, I had gotten, and it was exciting to realize how much stronger that I had gotten.
Great.
So I think sometimes it's good to go back and look where you started.
The progress.
Because you forget, you know, like when you're making gradual change, sometimes it's easy to forget to say, wow, look, I really have learned or really have improved or I really have created, you know, move forward.
What's the biggest skill you would say that you've acquired since doing the podcast or like the not being aware that you say like a lot, something that you've like a big lesson?
One of the lessons that I've learned is that it's very hard to predict what's going to resonate most with people. And it's always, because sometimes my sister and I will be like, oh, we think this is something that we're going to get a big response to.
And then it's, wah, wah.
Yeah. And then, and sometimes we're right. And then sometimes it's just like people. So just to take the most mundane example. So my sister, so in the podcast, we always we take turns giving ourselves a demerit, which is some mistake that we've made that has dragged down our happiness. So it's like, learn a lesson. You made a mistake. Do better next time. So one of the things Elizabeth gave herself a demerit was she had like 40 children to a 6-year-old's birthday party, and she didn't write everybody a thank you note. And I was like, I contest that demerit because I don't think you should have to do that. I would not expect myself to do that. They gave you the presents in person. He thanked them in person. It's just totally unrealistic to do this.
So I mean, write 40 handwritten.
40 handwritten thank you notes. I'm like,
that's
I just
a lot of work.
No, as an upholder, I'm like, I just simply would not expect myself to do that. And so, and this was just like a drive-by conversation that we had, you know? It wasn't meant to be like, ooh, this is the centerpiece of this conversation. And we were flooded. It turns out that people have so many nuanced views about thank you notes, written thank
receiving
you notes.
Gifts
to do. I mean, it turned, and it was just this giant thing. And you realize, I was like, I'm walking through the world having no idea about how people think about things. And here's how this happens too, like with being an upholder. So one of the things about upholders is they're very good at saying like, sorry, I can't do that. It's like, I'm sorry, I can't do that because I got to go for my run, or I'm sorry, I can't stay out late, I got to go to bed on time. And that can make them seem cold. Mm-hmm. But what it means is that they're very good at sort of saying to people, you're pushing too hard, or I can't meet that expectation. And what I didn't realize is, and I knew intellectually that for obligers particularly, it's difficult to do that. But then I found out, okay, so I'd been sending work emails over the weekend, and it had literally never crossed my mind not to do that. It wasn't like I was like, I thought about it and I decided it was okay. It was like, it never occurred to me not to send work emails over the weekend. Because my view was, read it over the weekend if you want. Answer it over the weekend if you want. If you want to wait till Monday morning, that's fine too. Like, whatever. You like, whatever works for you is fine. I just want to get it off my plate. I'm thinking about it. I'm just going to email you so I don't have to worry about it. So I discover, because this comes up kind of sideways in a conversation on the podcast with Elizabeth, and then we're flooded with emails with people being like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. My boss is always sending me emails, or, you know, or my coworkers are sending me these emails. It drives me crazy. I'm so resentful. It's like, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that. And so many kind listeners told me how to use delay delivery in Outlook, which I now know how to do. And so now I delay delivery until floods of emails go out at 6 a.m. on Monday morning.
You'll write it and then you'll put archive it. Or
yeah,
something.
I just put it delay. You just set delay delivery,
really?
And it
you
will
can
just
delay it.
Yeah, and
in
it will
Gmail.
Just go. No, I do it. Well, Outlook.
Okay,
that's what I do. How I do it.
Gotcha.
But this was something where I didn't know that this was a thing, because it's not a thing for me. So yeah. I didn't know that I was like tripping this wire in other people's heads.
Because you're very entrepreneurial. So
well,
it's
I'm
not
just
as...
like what? Yeah. I'm not working in an official team. It's like a bunch of different people sort of cobbled together. I mean, I'm not anybody's boss, but you know, it's not like there's an office policy where we all sit down and say like, oh, we're all going to commit to not to taking a real break. So I really learned something from that conversation. Again, kind of accidentally got into this territory of how the four tendencies come into play, self-knowledge, understanding how other people respond to things. And I did not see it coming at all. So one part of it is you just don't know.
Don't know.
Yeah.
So listen, we all know life is full of yada yada, like those quote unquote free trials that somehow still charge your card for something, or when companies have those sneaky gotchas hiding deep in the fine print. And I know you've dealt with yada yada before, like those bills that keep going up and up for no reason at all, or when budget airlines promise a cheap fare but then charge you for every little thing until you realize you're paying more than you would have somewhere else. And yes, it is possible to outsmart yada yada, like triple checking airline deals to make sure all you need is already included, but you don't take yada yada in life. So don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Metro by T-Mobile has no contracts, no credit checks, no surprises, and nada yada yada. Stop by one of over 6,000 Metro stores nationwide.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
What's been the most popular episode ever?
Well, in my mind, the most popular episode is episode 10, which was way back in the beginning, which is when we recorded me cleaning my sister's closet in Encino, California. It was just like me cleaning out her closet. I laugh every time. If I'm feeling blue, I go listen to that one because it was so funny.
It's the most popular.
For me, it's the most popular. That's the one that's the most popular for me.
What's the most downloaded one, do you know?
I don't know. Well, we did for our 100th, for our 1 year and 2 year anniversary, we did like a roundup show that was like highlights. And so those are super popular just because those are like best of episodes.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We got to do more of those.
They are really fun to do.
We gotta, like every 50, we should do like the top 10 moments. You know what I mean?
I think it's nice. We also did it because for people who are coming new and they don't know where to start, it's always kind of nice to have like a, you know, like
you can pick and choose which one you want
to
hear.
Yeah. And you're like, where do you start? Okay, we'll start with this one. Mm. Yeah. I think that's right.
What would you say you think about the most?
What do I think about the most? Isn't that an interesting question? Oh my gosh. That's so thought provoking. I think about, I think about people. I'm like, why are you, you know, like I'll read a memoir and I'll be, you know, like that's why did he do this or why did this happen? Or, I don't know. I'm always sort of looking up for these patterns. It's funny. I take a lot of notes. I take a gigantic amount of notes. And
use a notepad or do you use an iPad?
I type it into my desktop.
Computer notes.
My handwriting is so bad. I cannot.
Me too. I look like a 6-year-old child.
I know. I can't. And then you can't read it. I'm like, well, that's no good. And sometimes, often, I will take notes on something that I don't understand why I think it's important. You know, like I'll be like, I don't know why. That just seems notable, literally notable. So I take a note about it. And then sometimes months, weeks, years later, it will become clear to me why something is meaningful. I mean, like, for example, with the Four Tendencies, there was this Stephen Spender, who's a poet, wrote an autobiography. And as just kind of in passing, he was like, oh, and as happens with many soldiers, all his inner discipline had been destroyed by the discipline of the army or something like that, something to that effect. And I remember writing that down and being like, I wonder what's up with that. Like, is that true? Does the army destroy inner discipline by putting in outer discipline? Like, if it's true about the army, is it true about other institutions? Do I think this is right? Is Stephen Spender right or wrong? Like, you know, I just kind of pondered it for years. And I'm like, why do I even care? And then, of course, it fits perfectly into the Four Tendencies because it's like it's about meeting expectations and like and how expectations are met or not met. So I was like, you know, years later, it was like, oh, mystery solved. But somehow I'd picked up on that there was something striking there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time looking for stuff like that. Like, yeah, I'm always on the lookout.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Notable things.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I just read Phil Knight's memoir about Shoe Dog.
I want to read that.
It's good. I read it on an airplane.
on a business trip.
but as pleasure. And yeah, no, it's really good. Several people had said like, oh, you should just read it. It's such a good memoir. And it's really interesting because you're like, interesting guy. Interesting choices.
What are three books you think everyone should read besides your own?
I think everybody should read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. It's a towering classic of world literature, but it's also like an incredibly compelling page turner. It's beautiful. It's thought provoking. It's haunting. A lot of my favorite books are books that I can't in good conscience suggest that other people read because they're not to every, like I love Samuel Johnson, but he's an 18th century essayist and that's just not, or like Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. I love it. Love it, love it, love it. Is everybody ready to read a book by a founding father? It's not that accessible to all readers. So those are some books that I would recommend. I love so many books. It's just like my mind, I'm just staggering under the weight of everything.
How many do you think you've read?
Oh, a lot. I read a lot.
Thousands?
Yes, for sure. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's like all I like to do. I don't. I'm not well rounded, so if that's basically all you do,
what's something about you that almost no one knows about you, except for maybe your family?
I drink a ton of caffeine, coffee, tea, Diet Coke. But anybody who's near me knows that. Mm-hmm. So what's like some secret thing? I don't know. Gosh, I have to think about these things. I failed the national math exam in high school.
Whoa.
Yes. I was an A student in math because I just learned and I failed because it meant the way the national math exam works, it's like, and I think the SAT used to work like this. I don't think it does anymore. You got a base score of 200. And if you got something wrong, you got more points deducted than if you left it blank. Mm-hmm. So if you walked in, put in your name and walked out, you would have 200 points. I had less than 200 points because I'd gotten so many wrong. So I go in to talk to my math teacher. I think I was a junior or senior. And I was like, how do you explain this? Because I am an A student in math and I like could not do this. And he goes, well, Gretchen, you don't really understand math. You're just memorizing how to do it. And I was literally like, I didn't know that there was any other thing to do. I thought that everybody just memorized how to do math. I didn't like it was so far out of my conception that you could understand math. And that's what this test was meant to do. You had to kind of improvise. You had to solve problems. You had to apply math knowledge, which I was completely unable to do. But fortunately for me, I do not need to do high school math in my current everyday life.
I'd be screwed.
Yes, I know.
Elementary school math, I'd be screwed.
I know. Yeah, I'm like the calculator in the phone is like a major boon to mankind.
I remember I was sick. I think I had like the measles or something. I had some weird disease when I was like a kid. Is measles even a thing anymore? Yeah, people
chicken
have
pox.
That?
I don't think so. But you could have had chicken pox. Oh, really?
I had measles. Yes.
Really? That's very retro.
Yeah. It was like I was 7 or something, and I remember I missed like fractions that week.
And they come up a lot.
Fractions, right?
Yeah.
I missed the whole like week or 2 weeks of this. And I go back to school and they're going over fractions and it's just like I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
I couldn't get caught up. And it was like I never got caught up for the rest of my life.
Yes.
It was like that one thing helped me. I was like, no. Then it was algebra. Then it was whatever it was next. And I was just like, I just give up.
No.
I'm just going to cheat on everything. No. Just to get by.
No. It's like with a language. If you're like, I never really got the subjunctive. You're like, you kind of have to get that under your belt before you can move forward. Yeah. No, it is. It's that kind of...
it's tricky.
Incremental knowledge, yeah.
What would you say is the thing you're most proud of that people don't know about you?
Oh, I'm most proud
of something that you've done or been a part of that people don't know about, maybe.
Well, I was editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal when in law school, which is like a previous identity that I had. And that
Which school?
Yale Law School.
Yale Law School. Yeah. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and I was very proud of that, I have to say. That was and that's something that's just like now is not really relevant to my life, so people don't know it.
Yale Law.
Yeah.
You're a lawyer? Or you went to
law school? Yeah, no, and I clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor. But a lot of people know that I clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor. So that's not something that's not known.
Cool.
Yeah. So yeah, I have a whole lawyerly past.
Wow.
Which
lawyers are great writers.
Well, it's funny because sometimes people will be like, lawyer turned writer, Gretchen Rubin. I'm like, is there a deadlier phrase that you can use to describe anybody? It sounds so boring, right? Lawyer turned writer. And in fact, I have a couple of friends who are writers who like won't admit that they went to law school. I'm like, you went to law school, right? And they're like, I keep that under.
Didn't Jonathan Fields go to law school too?
He was a lawyer. Not 20 years.
Rich Roll was a lawyer.
Yes, he practiced real law for real time.
Long time.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I was only there for like 2 years, 3 years. Yeah. So I got out pretty quick. But yeah, no, there's a lot of us actually. You're right. Huh. There's a lot of us because I think a lot of people, and I think this absolutely describes me, is a lot of people go to law school not because they want to be lawyers, but because they're like, well, I'm good at research and writing and it's a great education and it keeps my options open and I can always change my mind later. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of kind of writerly people who go to it.
That's cool. Then
the fact is, I know a lot of people who love being lawyers, but they're people who want to be lawyers.
Really?
You know?
Yeah.
It's like if you want to be a lawyer, then you're happy being a lawyer. But if you didn't want to be a lawyer in the first place, it's like... well, that may not work out.
Yeah.
Like people don't become sound engineers by drifting into it. It's like you pick that, you know, but a lot of people drift into law.
That's true.
A lot of people drift into medicine. This is something that I've learned since in recent years, which I was surprised by. It seems so arduous to be a doctor.
Seems like a lot of work.
It does. And so I would think like, well, you'd have to want to be. And also it's sort of you just squeamishness and things like that. But a lot of people are like, oh, both my parents were doctors. You know, everybody I know is a doctor. I'm really good at math and science. And so people always said, oh, you should be a doctor. So I just sort of stumbled into it. I'm like, wow, that is a long road.
I feel like you'd want to just have a passion for like helping people.
Yeah.
You'd think.
Yeah.
And that's why you choose to be a doctor.
But a lot of people drift into it. It's interesting because every year I give a talk to this group of first year medical students. And it was been surprising to me how often they're kind of like, you know, I'm sort of here.
Crazy.
I know. I'm like, this is a lot of time and energy and money, my friends. Like, I would get clarity on that right now. Mm. You know, don't go all the way down this road.
What's the dream you've always wanted to... do that you haven't done yet?
Ooh, have my own television show. I think that would be fun.
About what?
Happiness. How to be happier, healthier, more productive, more creative.
What are you waiting for?
I don't know. I don't know. I should pursue that.
Why do you want to have a TV show?
Just because it'd be another way to reach a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a very, very strong medium. Probably the strongest medium right now. I mean, if you say television to mean... video content delivered to people on a screen. Because even the word television now, it's like...
it's changing.
I know somebody who's like, oh, we don't have televisions in our house. And I'm like, yeah, but I know your daughter watches 5 hours...
of video content.
The fact that it's not called a television
YouTube
set,
or
it's
whatever,
the same thing. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So why is that a big dream for you? Just because you want to reach more people?
Yeah,
with
just
this topic?
It'd be fun. It's like a new world to conquer.
What's it going to take to make that happen?
Well, I'd probably have to sit down and think about it, first of all.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. What would be the ideal network or placement for this show?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
Yeah. What about a PBS special? Doing something like that, getting it started.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
Aren't there a lot of authors that start with like PBS and then that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's all changing very fast. That's one of the things that's and all of it. I mean, television, radio, podcasting, publishing,
it's crazy.
Internet, you know, magazines, crazy what's happening there. It's all happening so fast, which is exciting because you do feel like you could get in there and really have fun and do new innovative things and maybe have opportunities that you wouldn't have had like 5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's changing so fast, you really feel like you need to keep abreast of a lot of changes because it's not so clear how to get from A to B because B is not where it was.
Mm-hmm. It could change in a year.
It could change. I mean, even something like Facebook. How do you use Facebook? I mean, that changes constantly.
Constantly
how you use Facebook.
I mean, I want to dissect this and we'll wrap it up with a few final questions, but I want to dissect this with books, newspapers, magazines, podcasts, TV. What other main mediums are we consuming? I guess social media, but kind of the traditional stuff. Radio, newspapers, magazines, books, podcasts, TV.
Well, podcast isn't traditional.
True.
It's new.
It's been around for 10 years. It's been kind of like...
It's like legacy media, podcast. I know. It's like...
What do you see is in the future, if you can kind of, you know, predict, what do you think is going to continue to accelerate? Are books going to continue to be popular for people? Or is it going to be more digital books? Is podcast going to be more popular than radio? Is newspapers completely dead? Are magazines still going to be relevant? What do you think is going to be the most relevant media?
Well, the thing is, with all these things, it seems to me like people want to create it and people want to consume it. The problem is, how do you get paid for it?
Yeah.
So people want to write books and people want to read books. How do people get paid to write books? Because that's changing. People love to read news articles and people love to write news articles. But how do you get the payment to the people who are writing them, mm-hmm. because there's so much changing in the world of advertising what you could charge. What can you charge for a book? What is the right price for a book? It's hard to know. So I feel like I don't even really know. And I feel like we don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. if people describe Snapchat to you, would you be like, oh, this is going to be a big thing? You'd be like, what is that? Like, there's no chance that's going to work out. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point of that? And then it's this huge thing. And it might rise and fall in the space of 2 or 3 years. So I don't know. I think we don't even know ourselves. It's just like the smartphone. Until the smartphone was invented, we had no idea of many things that we now crave and feel like are fundamental right.
Yeah.
What's going to, you know, what about augmented reality stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, what's that is like a whole new world. How are driverless cars going to affect media consumption? I feel like that's going to be a big change.
I drove a Tesla from San Diego to LA. Someone drove it and I was sitting in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
It was like a service, like a Tesla Loop thing it's called. It's like Uber for Tesla.
Oh, okay.
It's like a kind of a higher end service or whatever. And the guy literally just takes his hand off the wheel and is driving for like an hour in the lane, and it is... It's unbelievable. It's slowed down, so you're always 3 to 4 lengths behind the car in front of you.
Were you nervous?
I was like, this is crazy, because there were some turns. And he's like, no, it picks it up. It, like, all those sensors pick up the lane you're in and everything. And I was just like, he was just on his phone, just like,
you're kidding.
I swear to you. Like, no feet, no hands, just kind of like, yeah, you can just be on your phone. You can do this. Like, the car's got it handled. I was like,
so he didn't even really need to be there, or he had to get you like on there and off.
Yeah, it's like turning lanes or something. You know, it's like you turn the lanes yourself, you do some other things, but essentially you could just put cruise control and push a button, and then you say, "Yeah, I want to be like 7 lengths behind, car lengths behind," and it like goes back to 7 or whatever.
Wow, it was that's the future.
It was amazing. I was like, this is cool. If it works, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
But it was crazy. It's crazy. So anyways, we're going off here. But
I know, but I think that, I mean, if you could be anytime you're in a car, you could be watching a movie or reading a book or writing a book.
Not stressing about traffic.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's hard to imagine like what that's going to do to people.
Possibilities.
To their, because I mean, people love it. I mean, we have this insatiable desire for information, for stories, you know, for entertainment, for education, and it's just going to be a whole new opportunity to do it. So where is that going to go? I don't know.
Crazy. Do you feel like it's becoming easier for you to write and get your message out there because you've had success in the past? Or do you feel like because there's so much more competition, it's harder to get your message out there for a new book? Whereas maybe 10 years ago when you had a book and it was like, oh, if you get it in the cover of the New York Times, it's like going to blow up and that's all you need and you're a bestseller. And now, I don't know, is there a million books a year that come out? And so it's like, how do you compete with all these other topics and people?
Well, funnily enough, I think both are true. I think both of your alternatives are true. I think it is easier for me to get my word out because I do have kind of more known. And that, but then on the other hand, I think it is hard because there's just so much stuff that is tugging at people's attention. And people aren't all showing up at the same places the way they once were. Mm-hmm. So they're both are true simultaneously.
What are you doing differently as an author to get your message out there then? To make sure that your books are being, you know, getting in the hands of people? And
well, one thing that I really strive to do is to have a direct connection with my readers and listeners. I want to directly connect with them. So I don't want to have to depend on the New York Times to review my book for you to hear about it.
Because I think you were just in there. I saw, right? You had like a big cover.
The Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. That was great.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Yes, thank you. That
was awesome.
Yeah, it was a big picture.
It was huge. It was like full page
spread.
Was.
And my mother was like, oh my gosh. But that's what I think.
Having a direct connection with them.
It's having the direct connection because then you're not dependent on these middlemen who might support you, might not. It might not be the right thing for them, so they're not going to pick it up. Maybe like nobody's looking at this anymore. It doesn't have the social power that it once had. It doesn't command the same attention that it once had. So you've got to, it's like, and then even to do that, people are like, oh, the email list. No, people aren't answering their emails. Oh, you got to have a Facebook group. You know, all these, that itself is evolving all the time. How do you maintain a direct
connection
with
changing.
People? Yeah, but I'm lucky because my subject, it's like when people have given me so much insight and observation and examples. So I think for some writers, they in their heart of hearts, they feel like it's a distraction to be connected to readers and listeners because they're sort of like, well, I just need to go off and do my thing. But for me, it's so illuminating. Like
the feedback.
I mean, it's just like with the Four Tendencies, it's crammed with examples of people. And I could never have invented those examples because I just don't have the range of experience. You know, like there's one, it was a woman talking about being a missionary, LDS missionary. I don't know what that was like. And here she has, or, you know, or somebody like a doctor talking about like examining different kinds of patients. I don't know what that's like. So it kind of jumpstarts my understanding of ideas because people are constantly, or like, I remember with Better Than Before, I talked about how some people are abstainers and some people are moderators when it comes to Strong Temptation, that for some people, it's easier to have none than to have a little bit. So when I first introduced this idea, which I got from Samuel Johnson, by the way, speaking of Samuel Johnson, I thought I was in the very, very small minority. I never heard anybody talking about this, except in the context of addiction, true addiction, alcohol addiction, cigarette addiction. There, people are like, "Yeah, you have to give it up altogether." But with everything else, people are like, "Indulge a little bit. Moderation is pleasant to the wise. It's not healthy to be too rigid." All this stuff, and I was like, "You know what? I can't hack it. It's too hard for me to have moderation." And then I was overwhelmed with people being like, "Oh my gosh, I'm exactly like you. I didn't know that there was. I thought it was just me. I thought something was wrong with me. My husband kept telling me I should be able to have, one brownie, or my doctor kept telling me to have half a dish of ice cream." Or, my best friend can have half a glass of wine. Why can't I? Yeah, and I'm like, this is the way some people are. I'm like this. And it was so reassuring for me to realize, oh, there's a ton of people like this.
Yeah.
Maybe half the world is like this. I don't know. I can't never really tell the numbers. But I wouldn't have understood that truth if I hadn't heard from people responding to it and saying, yes, this is how I experience this, or not. And so I feel really lucky that for me, it really feeds what my work.
Sure.
It's not a distraction.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, final four questions for you.
Okay. Is this a lightning round?
Maybe. Yes, okay. Maybe. The first one is, what's the question you wish everyone asked you but they never do?
Ooh, see, you're asking all these thought-provoking questions that I feel like I should have thought about for a month. What question do I wish...
More people would ask.
No, oh, yeah. Where can listeners learn more about your stuff? I like it when people ask that question. GretchenRubin.com. What question do I wish people would ask me? I wish they would ask.
A meaningful question.
No. I get it. Yeah. A meaningful question. I don't know. I get good questions.
Mm-hmm. Then what's your favorite question that you get?
How can the four tendencies help people be happier, healthier, more productive, more creative? Because I feel like that's like goes to the heart of it. Because it's like the whole point of this is to make your life better. It's not just it's just not idle curiosity. Though idle curiosity is fine too. I think sometimes it's like a BuzzFeed quiz. It's fun. Yes. It's fun. Yes. It's fun to have a vocabulary and to sort of put yourself in a category. But
do you feel like we answered that question?
Yeah, I think
we did.
Okay,
good. Just making sure.
No, you got there right away. Good. That's why I hesitated to bring it up.
Cool. All right. Well, this is called The Three Truths. I can't remember if I asked you the last time, but we'll ask it again. If this was the last day for you on Earth, many years from now, you've written every book you want to do. You did that big TV show that you always dreamed about. Yeah, okay. Anything else you imagine, it came true.
Okay.
Everything. And yet it was all erased from history. All your books are gone. Uh-huh. No one has access to any information you've ever put out there. Podcast, vanish.
Uh-huh.
And you had a piece of paper and a pen to write down the three lessons or the three truths that you knew to be true about all your experiences in life. And this is the only thing that would be remembered by you, these three truths.
Okay. What are they?
What would you write down?
Okay, the first would be Gretchen. That's my first personal commandment, to be Gretchen. Everybody has to fill in their own name, but I think that is at the core of a happy, healthy, productive life. Know yourself. One is the days are long, but the years are short, which is like, remember that everything passes. Enjoy it while it lasts. And the third thing is, one of the best ways to make yourself happy is to make other people happy. One of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy yourself. Ta-da! Three truths. Okay,
those
good.
Are good. Yeah. Those are good. Before I ask the final question, I want to acknowledge you for a moment for helping so many people heal themselves. Because I feel like people suffer when they don't feel happy.
Yeah.
They're suffering, they're going through pain, and when they don't know how to get out of it, they don't know how to find happiness within, they continue the suffering in other people and they create suffering around them.
Yes.
So you've impacted so many people through giving them simple tools to make them heal and find happiness and joy, and it's spreading throughout the world. So I acknowledge you for helping so many people feel
happier.
Well,
I so appreciate that.
I want to make sure everyone gets your book, The Four Tendencies. Make sure to pick it up. You can pick it up anywhere right now. GretchenRubin.com has more information, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that good stuff. We'll have it in the show notes as well. And the final question is, what's your definition of greatness?
I think it's living up to your aims for yourself. And some people have very ambitious aims and some people have less ambitious aims. But if you live up to your aims for yourself, that's greatness.
Double high five.
Double high five. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. There you have it, my friends. I hope you enjoyed this one. Another powerful episode on the School of Greatness podcast. If this is your first time here, make sure to tag me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and let me know what you thought about this at Lewis Howes on social media. I'd love to connect with you and hear your feedback on this episode. Also, make sure to subscribe and leave a review over on iTunes. The new podcast app on your iPhone allows you to easily click a 5-star rating and leave a review now. Before, it used to be really challenging to leave reviews. Now you just open up your app, scroll right to the podcast, scroll down a little bit, and you'll see right there, click on 5 stars and leave a review. I'd love for you to do that and let me know when you do so I can connect with you and learn more about what you enjoyed about this episode. We're building a powerful movement, guys. We can't do it without you. We need your support if we want to continue to inspire the world, entertain and educate with powerful ideas, showcase important people's messages, and spread it to the world. So continue to share the message of greatness. If you want to learn more about the School of Greatness, check out the full show notes at lewishowes.com/541. You can also check out the full video, all the links. Make sure to grab a copy of Gretchen's new book. And if you do anything, just share it with one friend you think this would be valuable for. Again, it means the world to me that you listen, and every time you share, it helps us get the message out there just a little bit more. And Donald Miller said, when you stop expecting people to be perfect, you can like them for who they are. Make sure to take that today and think about the people in your life. Think about the intimate relationships. Think about your family relationships, your friendships, the people that you work with, the people that are actually closest to you all the time. Stop expecting people around you to be perfect and start seeing them for who they are. Start seeing them for the good that they do have and start focusing on and acknowledging that in them right now. I love you guys, and you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day disinfecting wipes conveniently tackle surfaces, including remotes, tablets, and smartphones, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.